Well, our next presenter is a gentleman who has a unique knowledge. Now, we've all seen Air Force One flying around the president around the country, sometimes around the world, but how many of us really know what goes on behind the scenes of that most famous airplane? Well, Greg Cahan is with us tonight, and he is a former Air Force One pilot. So if anybody knows the answers to the questions about everything you wanted to know about Air Force One but didn't know who to ask, Greg's the man. Please join me in welcoming Greg Cahan. Greg.
Is the mic working okay? Sounds like it. Well, I am Greg Cahan, and I'm here to talk to you about Air Force One, which, as you can see in the picture. Before we get started, I just want to go over some, call them ground rules, but if you have questions, I have a hard time seeing in the audience right now, but if you have questions during the show, don't hesitate. Just raise your hand, and if I don't see you, yell out, like my friend Jim over here. I can see him. Yell out, because if you wait till the end, you probably forget what you wanted to ask. But go ahead. Don't worry about interrupting. Everyone's got all night if you're camping out here, right? And also, during the presentation, there's going to be some pictures. I got about 14 slides that lead me through the presentation. And if I don't take the time to try to explain the significance of the picture, then go ahead and stop me, because some of them have some funny stories, some good stories behind them. Some of them don't have any stories, and I'll just tell you, it was just a picture I liked. So. Also, there's just a couple of things I've signed disclosure agreements about with the government. So if you ask a question and I tell you that I can't answer, I'm not trying to play, I've got a secret, and it's just that I don't want to go to jail for 20 years and pay $10,000 fine or $100,000. Anyway. We'll get going. First picture right off the bat, because no one's asked me yet. This is November 30th, 2006. Significant to me, this was my last flight on the 747 on Air Force One. I was actually taxiing in that day. I was in the left seat. And that was in Amman, Jordan to Andrews Air Force Base with President Bush. And the funny thing about that, it's a tradition in the Air Force on your last flight that when you get off the airplane, there's going to be a fire truck there that's going to hose you down. It's a pretty ridiculous tradition, but tradition at that. And the president had come up and told me that I wasn't the smartest guy in the world because I picked November 30th in Washington, D.C. to be hosed down. And he gave me a little bit of grief, and he actually had got off the airplane, and he was on the stairs, and he looked back up in the cockpit, and it was 75 degrees. And he gave me a thumbs up, and I got hosed down by my wife, and it all worked out okay. Anyway, we'll move on. All right, this is what I talk about. First of all, people ask that, you know, how did I get involved with Air Force One? And I guess when you meet me, it's not too obvious that I should be picked to fly Air Force One, I guess. But, so I'll go ahead and tell you how I got there, how I got chosen, give you a little insight on how they pick pilots for Air Force One. Then I'll talk about the actual star of the presentation, and that's the airplane itself. Go through, I have some diagrams of the inside, and kind of take the mystery out of what the airplane is all about. And then talk about the people that make up the squadron, or the group it is, of Air Force One. And then I'll talk about the mission, how we build missions, some of the things we have to think about, and some of the things you see on National Geographic that tell you some truths and some non-truths, and we'll try to clear some of those up. And then if you have any questions at the end, we'll talk about it. This picture right here is my first operational landing in the 747. I was sent to United Airlines to train to fly the 747. And the first time I actually landed with passengers on board, that's Colorado Springs. And that was actually the backup airplane, and we'll get into the primary and the backup a little bit later. But that was the backup airplane, and they thought it would be funny to have the brand new captain, youngest Air Force One pilot ever, try to do his first landing at 7,200 feet pressure altitude. And there's a lot of pilots in the room that understand what that means. So it was the hardest landing of my life and the hardest landing of a lot of people's lives. And the way we measure bad landings on the 747 on Air Force One is how many ceiling tiles in the conference room fall on the floor. And I broke all records that day. So I guess people are right. It doesn't have to be a good pilot. It just has to be a pilot in the right place. Okay, who am I? I have no military or aviation experience in my background, except my father, Korea War, he was in the Army for a little while. I think he peeled potatoes for about 10 days and then he was released. But I grew up outside of Logan Airport in Boston, and I watched 747s come in every day and said, you know, I'd really like to do that and escape the confines of Massachusetts. And if you're a Republican, you understand that. And the only way I could do it, I went to the United States Air Force Academy. And I was an engineering major, engineering mechanics. And my roommate at some portions of that time and my squadron mate, Jim Davis, is actually here from St. Louis. It's the first time I've probably seen you other than one quick moment in the last 20 years. But graduated from the Air Force Academy as a second lieutenant. I moved on to pilot training. I went to Reese Air Force Base in Texas. And I flew the T-37s and T-38s. And if anyone's, there's probably a lot of people here that's been through military pilot training. Yeah, you know. Well, I know Jim has. But for a guy with no aviation background, I flew a T-37, which is, a lot of people know, they call it the Tweet. Two engines side-by-side cockpit. And they say it turns JP-4 into noise. And then a little bit of thrust is a byproduct of that noise. So I flew those. I think I really gave us 75 hours in those. So that was my entire aviation experience. And then they put us in the T-38. And within, I think it was 8 to 10 hours, we were soloing. And if you know what a T-38 is, it's the equivalent of an F-5 fighter. It's got it's basically two engines with afterburners and two picnic tables for wings. And it proves the theory about, you know, if you can strap a rocket on a brick and make it fly. But I managed to graduate from pilot training, did well enough to pick my airplane, and I wanted to move on. So I went and flew a C-141, a heavy airplane. And I got based on the East Coast, where I was allowed to travel all over the world, which was really the whole reason I wanted to fly. So I managed 7 years out of the East Coast and over 120 countries at the time. And I flew nuclear weapons, I flew for the State Department, and I did some other things for another department in the government. Got to find out all the places where wars were happening and never see on TV, so it was interesting. But what that did was, for my next assignment, which was flying Gulfstreams, G3s, at Andrews Air Force Base outside of Washington, D.C., my security clearance was so high that kind of led me into flying for the president, who also has three G3s on top of the 747s that everyone recognizes. So I flew for Clinton, that was in 1993, and as soon as an opening came up in the 747, I was asked, because I was already kind of a fixture with the Clintons, I was asked to fly the 747. So I started flying the 747 in 97, flew it all the way to 2000, and then they gave me a break. And I went and got a couple of master's degrees. I went to Scott Air Force Base, and I bought and sold airplanes for the government and modifications to all the VIP airplanes, to include Air Force One. Which kind of leads me into the reason why one of the things I can't talk about, which someone around here is going to ask, is the defensive systems on Air Force One, how it protects itself. And since I was part of the procurement program, I can't talk about it. So maybe I can head off that question. So that's how I got to fly Air Force One. Kind of the right person in the right time. There's only 8 pilots that fly it. And when they were looking for someone, you either have to die, get fired, or retire. And someone did one of those three just in time for the Clintons to ask me to come on the 747. So, any questions about that? Pretty basic stuff. got you through that. Now we can get to the good stuff. Oh, this picture. Can you see this picture very well? It's hard to. And I don't have a pointer, and I can't point to anything. Anyway, the guy in the front is Mark Tillman. You probably see him on National Geographic, and Wolf Blitzer did a big interview. He was the commander when I retired. And then there's an engineer that's in the forefront. And then you can see me between the guy in the back. What was that? President Bush, that's right. He's the guy in the back. That picture, we were 500 feet over the threshold in Baghdad. And the reason we all look like we're having a good time, like we're on the Space Mountain or something like that, is because this is the daylight landing at Baghdad that made all the papers, because we actually went in the middle of the day instead of at night sneaking in there. And the president thought that it was an absolute secret. There wasn't anyone on the planet that knew about it except him and the three of us up there and the people that were in the back. So as we got to about 500 feet on the approach, a Marine helicopter spun around and looked into our cockpit, and the president looked over there, and the president said, "I bet that guy just shit his pants." And just as he said it, we all started laughing, and the photographers went crazy. And before we even got home, that was the cover of the USA Today. Another funny story that comes from that picture was, we couldn't tell our friends or our family what we were doing, but it was a really secret trip. But my wife, who was working for the Pentagon at the time, was on a trip, and she was coming out of her hotel room, and on her floor was the USA Today, and she had looked down and she said, "That's my husband." And there was some woman walking down the aisle, said, "No, that's the President of the United States." Anyone recognize that picture? No? Okay. Now we'll talk about the star of the show, the airplane. I put this in here after guys remember the big New York incident that happened when right after Obama was inaugurated? I put this in here because this is the stock photo that we've used since 1991, which I thought was a pretty good picture, but someone decided it wasn't good enough and decided to fly around at high speed around the skyscrapers in New York. So, anyway, okay. So Air Force One is not just the 747, it's any Air Force airplane that the President of the United States happens to be on. So if he is on an Air Force Cessna 172, from Colorado Springs Air Force Base or the U.S. Air Force Academy, then that is Air Force One that day. Believe it or not, I have flown, not actually piloted all of these, but I have flown Air Force One on a 747, a G3, a 757, a DC-9, and a C-17, believe it or not. C-17, Air Force One. But everyone knows Air Force One as the 747-200, which is a classic 747. I know there's 747 pilots in the room, right? Yeah. It's a classic. It's a 200 with the giant G400 engines. So it's a lighter weight 747 if you consider the 400, but it's got the big engines. So we get a lot of giddy up on it. Believe it or not, we cannot max out the airplane as far as weight. We can't, if we fill up the gas, we only seat about 65 passengers. So the 747 normally seats around 400, so we can't even max out the airplane. As much as we try sometimes with spare parts and communications gear. So the first one, 28,000, was delivered, you can see there, in September of 1990, and the second one, March of 1991. Both of them were significantly late. They were supposed to be delivered in time for President Reagan before he had to leave. But Boeing was late, and they claimed that they lost a lot of money on delivering those airplanes late, like $1 million apiece. And I will tell you right now, they have made up for that about 30,000 times since delivery, because they are in charge of our maintenance as far as parts and all the heavy maintenance visits. But the airplane itself is, you can see there, 4,000 square feet, specially configured 747 on three levels. The bottom level is mostly refrigeration, baggage, and spare parts. We do have chillers, kind of like the movie Air Force One, if you're trying to draw some comparisons, except we don't have the nice glass that you can shoot the milk through. But we have a pretty healthy spare parts inventory on the airplane itself. We usually travel with eight tires, which one time when we landed in Saudi Arabia, we found out eight wasn't enough for spares. So I think we blew 10, 124 degree runway temperature. And that's about it downstairs. It has something very unique. It has its own luggage conveyor belt that will swing outside the airplane, and we can load luggage. The basic theory behind the airplane is always be able to service it remotely, places where you're not going to have an airline come up to you and provide all the services. So we have a lot of special features of the airplane. Air stairs that come out the bottom, so you can get on and off without a stair truck. Let me go to the next slide. It's a little better of pointing things out. Talk about that's the bottom level I told you about. Now, the main level is where everything happens on board. If you go from the front of the airplane, you can see that's where the president's suite is. So he has two couches that follow the contour of the body from the nose. And those couches will come out to be beds. And with President Clinton, we had one always made up into a bed. And that was don't chuckle. Now. It's because he had a bad knee. Remember the knee incident in Florida? So we always had the bed made up for him because he would like to lie down with the bad knee. And if the First Lady was going to come with us on a long trip over the ocean, then we'd have both beds made up. Also, there's a small desk in there you can see. Is that coming out clear enough for you guys to see? And I can't point to it, but there's a small desk there. And then there's a bathroom that has a very nice shower. And if you can see, there's two places there on the vanity, two sinks. And I always tell the story that we tested it, that you will get a fire alarm if you have two women drying their hair at the same time at 30 West over the Atlantic. And that got a lot of attention. And as the Secret Service barged through the doors to find Hillary and Chelsea drying their hairs. It was fun for a lot of people, but me. I was alone in the seat that night. Okay, you go back into the president's suite, which I think, let me see. Yeah, that little picture has the president's suite. You know, that's Dan Quayle sitting there? Well, Bush Jr. was president. I have no idea why that happened. I don't remember him ever being on the airplane. But so you see his suite there. He has a very large desk, nice couch that follows the perimeter of the aft wall. There was a window there that was right by the desk, and the Secret Service, before it was delivered, asked to have that window plugged because they were worried it was a direct firing shot into the window if a sniper wanted to try to use it. And President Bush, 41, when he got on board, he was used to that window on a 707. He asked, why is that? I can't see outside the window when I'm sitting at my desk. So Boeing offered to remove the plug and replace it. And I think the price was a mere $800,000. And our maintenance guys did it on a weekend, and it cost $350. FAA didn't certify it, though. And we went back about 3 years later for certification of some of the things we had to do for $350 instead of $800. It cost us about $500,000 to get the certifications. So I don't know who wins there.